The DMR had formulated a grand plan for a Sydney road network stretching from the city to Newcastle. Tony Prescott, a professional historian with the New South Wales Heritage Office, was then a Hunters Hill resident.
A road network vision for the city, and it seemed to me to be almost to sort of replace the public transport city with a very car-oriented city. There certainly was a mania for cars in this period. I guess with the growing post-war affluence and that, every family had to have one, and this certainly generated a pressure for road building and an expectation that the roads would be improved to meet the demands of the traffic. It also marks a bit of a watershed in the shape of Sydney, I guess, in that this period post-war marks the transformation of the city from a walking and public transport city in the European style to a North American style motor vehicle based city. There's no question about that. I think that's the sort of broader context. So this creates this powerful demand which structures like the Glaswell Bridge are a product of.
The plan was for a new bridge downstream of the existing Iron Cove Bridge and a new road just east of the existing Victoria Road connecting with Gladesville Bridge, thence via Tarbin Creek and Fig Tree Bridges and up the Lane Cove Valley to connect with the expressway to Newcastle.
The site chosen for the bridge, there would have been a few criteria. One was the position of the main road leading to the site, wherever it would be, and another is the terrain, and another consideration is how wide the width of the river at the proposed point. In this case, the point chosen, they had a good favourable topography for approach roads because this had to be a very high bridge. The main reason for the new bridge being so high was that it was anticipated that very large ships would be coming up there in the years to come. This didn't eventuate, but huge oil tankers and all manner of heavy, high shipping, and that's the reason for the high clearance. And the topography lent itself to a high bridge.
Phil Hallinan was a maintenance engineer with the DMR. But what sort of an organisation was the DMR at that time?
It was known in some respect as the Department of Mineral Relations, as in DMR, but it was a somewhat bureaucratic organisation, a lot bigger and old-fashioned, more in the old public service mould.
I think it was obvious even then that the DMR had a lot of, I'm not sure if a lot of power is the right term, but it was very well placed in the public service in terms of its self-confidence and esteem and so on, and it was certainly the organisation you could get lots of nice glossy literature out of, and they had a lot of self-confidence in that, and their position seemed to be relatively unchallenged, and you could compare that with the railways, who seemed to be constantly under siege and always on the defensive, and that, you know, they were in a very strong position, they knew it, and you know, it certainly has been said they were almost a de facto planning authority. They had that much strength. As far as roads are concerned, I don't think the planning authorities sort of really wanted to move into their territory. The DMR did the road planning and the planning authorities filled in the bits in between, so to speak.
There are stories that back in the days of John Shaw as a commissioner, and even one or two after him, that the minister would come down to his office and sit out and wait until Shaw was ready to see him, which is a bit different to the situation that's probably applied over the last 20 or 30 years. It was an organisation that was very much run along military lines in those days, and a lot of the bosses at the time had wartime experience and had served in construction regiments. The structure was military in that we had divisions and various officers at officer level. There were certain efficiencies, I think, from that process as well, in terms of mobilising numbers of men to do work at the field level and having a chain of command where you could react quickly to emergencies. And to have, it was also a very engineering-oriented organisation, and as such, the engineers, and they get criticised for wanting to build expensive, grand things, and there was possibly an element of that, but by and large, they very much frustrated if they can't make things happen. They didn't want to spend too much time planning and thinking about what might happen. They wanted to make it happen.
In those sort of civil engineering areas, particularly, the engineer was king. I mean, engineers have always had a ascendant role in society, I think, because they tend to inspire with large-scale works, I guess.